Good morning. Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The typical American lawn and garden can be defined as an English garden, sweeping lawn with separate areas for flowers and vegetables. This landscape form and its popularity in America was the result of a painstaking public relations campaign in the 19th century undertaken by seed and garden companies. A new book, America's Romance with the English Garden, details the history of this media campaign and its impact on American gardens. Author Thomas Mickey, a master gardener and landscape designer, who's also emeritus professor in communication studies at Bridgewater State University, joins us from our studios at WGBH in Boston. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
So your book looks at both gardening and advertising, and I'm curious about where the idea for this book came from. Were you wearing your gardening hat or your professorial hat when the idea came to you?
Oh, that's a great question. I was interested for a long time in the values of advertising and marketing and public relations, and I put that together with my interest in gardening, and I made a proposal to the Smithsonian to come and study how the garden was marketed in the 19th century. And that was the kind of the springboard for the whole book.
Yeah, so you spent about a year redoing research at the Smithsonian. So tell us what you were examining and where their collection came from.
Well, what I examined was the only way that you can study marketing of the garden in the 19th century was to look at catalogs. That was the major source for getting what they had to sell to the public. So I looked at catalogs from the early 1800s until the end of the century, and I did that at the American History Museum, but mostly at the Department of Agriculture Library in Beltsville, Maryland, which has probably the largest collection of catalogs, I think, in the U.S. But you could only study the marketing and advertising by looking at the catalog. Mr. Burpee, who is one of the most colorful seedsmen in the 19th century, said, the catalog is the silent salesman.
Yeah.
So he knew advertising really well and admitted that from the get-go.
And you've got some really great illustrations in the book. We forget how beautiful some of those illustrations were.
Yes. By the end of the century, the introduction of chromolithography had really, really taken off, and the catalog covers were really beautiful, and as they were used in a lot of other businesses as well.
Yeah.
And by the end of the century, they became not only more colorful but also bigger. They were almost like little books.
Right. So anyone who's watched the opening credits, the credit scene from Downton Abbey, has a good idea of the formal English garden: long sweeping lawns, distinct flower garden areas. We can just sort of picture, Hugh walking with his lab in those credits. Most Americans to this day still maintain part of their landscape as lawn, and I'm imagining not realizing where this influence comes from.
Well, the lawn was really important in English garden history, especially in the 18th century. But into the 19th century, the English garden was defined, this is how I'm talking about it in the book, was defined as primarily the lawn, the flowering shrubs on the lawn, the trees to line the property, a curved walkway, and the kitchen garden or vegetables and herbs behind the house. But it was the lawn that was the predominant symbol of that garden. Even William Robinson in 1883, who was probably one of the most important garden writers in England at that time, said the lawn is the heart of the English garden.
Mm-hmm. And of course, nowadays, we still have people who really want that perfect lawn, and there's so many methods, controversial sometimes on how much fertilizer and chemicals and all of that. How did they make the lawns so beautiful at that time before we had all of these technologies of today?
Well, one of the things that we know before industrialization, that the garden was really located primarily, that English garden was located on properties of the very wealthy people who had large estates. And so they had staffs of gardeners who could maintain the height of the lawn at whatever the owner wanted. Eventually, in 1830, the lawnmower was introduced, and then it came to America shortly thereafter. But it was a painstaking kind of effort before the introduction of a lawnmower, with more scythe and even animals helping to keep that lawn trim. But it was really important to have that trimmed lawn.
You know, it's funny as you're saying that, I'm thinking of a neighbor I had when I lived in Indiana, and he and his wife had this beautiful lawn. They didn't use any chemicals or anything, but you know what? They used to go out there and literally hand dig every dandelion out of their lawn.
Oh, that's so, really
dedicated, right?
Boy.
Yeah.
Boy, that's really being obsessed. I was in England a couple of weeks ago, and I saw this. I was talking to this guy, and I said, do you have a lawn? He said, do I have a lawn? I'm obsessed with my lawn. And I said, you are? Tell me about that. So then he told me how careful he is about weeds and maintaining it at a certain height. And he lives in the suburbs, but in a rather small property, but still quite proud of his lawn.
Exactly. We have a love, and that's something that's interesting here. For me, you know, on Cape Cod, is, you know, we have this, if you have a brown lawn in August, it's not a problem for most of us. But some people, you know, they really want to have that green, perfect lawn. For me, if it's green, I don't care if it's crab grass, it's green.
That's actually the way that I feel in my own garden. Yeah. I don't mind a few weeds coming up because I really don't have a large lawn. I have patches of lawn, which I can maintain relatively easily.
Right. Well, early Americans had vegetable gardens for food, but early in our country's history, it was the wealthy Americans also who had the more formal gardens. So can you describe the early American gardens and some of the first connections with the English garden model?
Well, a couple of points here. Number one, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson both loved the English garden, and Jefferson went to England and visited these English garden estates that had these extensive landscapes with these big lawns, and he wanted to replicate that on his own property in Monticello. Outside of Boston, there's a wonderful garden in Waltham called the Lyman Estate, which was created towards the end of the 1700s, early 1800s, and that still exists today with this extensive lawn flowing from the house. Mm. And so it was outside large cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, where people who had money were able to have these extensive lawns very much like the English. And eventually, when people had more money, when industrialization became really important and people could move to the suburbs, it was that lawn that the wealthy people had that now the middle class wanted to have. Mm-hmm. And so houses in the suburbs, for example, were often advertised in the 1870s as, now you can have a lawn. The house is moved back far enough from the street so you can have your own lawn, which, of course, is what people wanted.
Right. And you write that even though the French, Spanish, and Italians had distinct gardening styles, it was the English garden that was the easiest for companies to symbolize and illustrate. So that's part of the reason that they used it as a model. But what are some of the features that distinguish Spanish and Italian garden styles?
Well, Italian gardens, that's a great question. Italian gardens really became important towards the end of the 19th century in America with Edith Wharton's summer residence, The Mount, out in Lenox there. And she wrote a book even on Italian gardens. She's a wonderful gardener, very, very perceptive landscaper herself. But the Italian garden is known for its terraces, for example. They each have an individual feature so that the garden has grades going down to a certain level. That's one of the distinctive features of the Italian garden, with fountains, of course, and statuary. Mm-hmm. The French garden was noted for its formality, exemplified in the greatest formal garden of all time, the Garden of Versailles, where the formality was the key to not only constructing it, but to maintaining it as well. I think part of the reason that the English garden was featured in the catalog, as I discovered, was that many of the owners were from Great Britain, were mm-hmm. Scottish, Irish, and English gardeners themselves. And so when they came here, one of the things they wanted to do was get into the garden business. And of course, this was the model, this was the kind of garden they knew. But over and above that, over and over again, I saw, as I looked at the catalogs, the same kind of cover appeared in each of these catalogs, no matter where they came from, Philadelphia, New York, even from the Midwest. The catalog cover was often quite similar, especially with the lawn. And that's what drove me to kind of the central thesis of the book, that by the end of the century, just like people wanted Quaker oats, they didn't want just oatmeal, and they wanted ivory soap. They didn't want any old soap. So they wanted a garden that was illustrated on the covers of the catalogs. And that was clearly the English garden.
That's a really interesting point, too, that you bring up about that being the same no matter where in the country you are, because we certainly have completely different growing conditions. And you know, I know even that to this day, we still struggle to try to put things into our landscape here that really don't belong, you know, that we just can't seem to sustain.
Exactly. That was quite common. People in California, for example, out west, wanted a garden just like the gardens of New England. And so they had the lawn, they had the flower beds on the lawn, which, of course, demanded a lot of maintenance and, of course, water.
Right.
And so the same garden appeared from California to Maine. That's been documented in several different ways. For example, people would have, if your property was a beautiful landscape, it was very common in the 19th century for a business who would come and illustrate your property and then include it in a book of prominent homes in that community.
Mm.
And you could, of course, get a copy of this because you had paid for that illustration. And you can see in those illustrations the gardens, for example, in Nevada City, California, are identical to gardens that are on the East Coast with the lawn and the shrubs and the two vases. There were always two vases on the lawn. That was a kind of a Victorian example of gardening. But same kind of garden was clear across the country.
Yeah, talk about a lot of work. You know, we think in Nevada doing an English garden, it's tough to keep it going. Yeah,
exactly.
So with the English garden model, there were vegetable or kitchen gardens along with the lawns. But those gardens, of course, were in the back, as we mentioned, the side of the home, not out front. And we still see that today, don't we? Lawn and flower beds out front with the vegetables tucked away. I know I guess it makes sense out the back door of my kitchen is where I have my herb garden, but pretty much everybody's sort of stuck with that model.
Exactly. It's, in one sense, it's very practical because you just go out your kitchen door and you can grab a couple of tomatoes. Or as I do, the other day I grabbed some parsley because I was making something. And that's very convenient, but it certainly is the English model. Mr. Henderson, who was a wonderful seedsman in the 19th century, was very critical of people who would mix flowers and vegetables. He said one time in his catalog, we can excuse the wife of a day laborer planting her seeds of morning glory or lady slipper in the potato or corn patch, but when the owner of a $10,000 cottage, which today would be about $250,000, has the vulgarity to invade his flower beds with beets or tomatoes, he is carrying his utilitarian principles beyond the bounds of ordinary good taste.
Uh-oh, I'm guilty. I have perennial beds, and this year I haven't, but sometimes I'll throw a tomato plant in there or some basil, and you know, and it's funny because you know you see people who come and wander through the garden, they'll go, "Is that a tomato?"
Is that a tomato? Right, in your flower patch, perennial garden.
They assume it's a volunteer, but no, I put it there on purpose.
There was a lot of in the catalogs, the essays and the articles were wonderful illustrations of how people were motivated to gardening. And one of the ways you were motivated was to help your neighbor, to encourage your neighbor to have the kind of lawn that's going to be very much like your lawn, so that the lawn will sweep into to the neighbor's lawn, which is what people wanted in this country. So as you go down the streets in a suburb, for example, you see one lawn meeting the other lawn. It's like the whole street is one big lawn from beginning to the end. And that's kind of a democratic view of the lawn, as it were.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Thomas Mickey about his book, America's Romance with the English Garden. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. So around the time of industrialization, there were a confluence of social factors that caused gardens and gardening to become more prevalent, right? More wealth, more leisure time.
And advertising.
Right.
advertising, for the first time, probably in late 1880s, for the first time, people were inspired by what was advertised. Before that, it was what your neighbor said to you, what was happening in your community, in your town, or in the rural area where you lived. But for the first time, after about 1875, 1880, advertising really took off as a way to sell a product, and usually a standardized product. So everybody had the same kind of clothing or wanted the same kind of clothing and shoes and so forth.
Yeah. And as you, I mean, when you think about it, we had, you know, cheaper paper, faster printing, mail delivery, and so this, you know, was easy to spread. And this wasn't accidental. I mean, this was really, you know, thought out. Hey, we can, you know, as Burpee was saying, the you know, brochures or catalogs being the salesperson.
Exactly. That was really surprising to me as I saw the catalog by about 1880. It was so beautiful, both on the cover and inside, in the black and white illustrations that were often inside, but sometimes color, and the amount of space that the owners used inside to talking about gardening. For example, it was not uncommon for them to say, teach your children mm-hmm. how to garden. Your children will enjoy nature. Your children will get out and not be involved in silly games. And when you teach your children how to garden, give them really good seeds. Don't give them old seeds from last year. Give them good tools, not your tools that have seen the light of better day, and give them also a good plot of soil so they will see the results of their work. It was a wonderful way to inspire children.
Yeah, and you've got a couple of, again, great illustrations and kind of, I guess, playing up to the mom thing because, you know, a lot of these people looking at these catalogs and brochures were women. So, you know, these beautiful illustrations with the children and the gardening, it worked.
Exactly. I found that by the end of the 1880s, the catalogs, the market for the catalog is primarily women, because it was women who were often illustrated on the cover and inside working in the garden. Women were often illustrated. So it was, and women at that time became the major buyer for the home, the shopper. So it was not uncommon to have a woman on the cover.
Yeah. So this really then was the beginning of the modern day advertising approach in which companies are not just trying to sell a product, but also an image.
Correct. A branding, a way of looking at the garden. It wasn't just a garden. It was a garden that we show you on our catalog cover. And that was a really important moment in the construction, really, of what we understand to be modern gardening, where the person that we're targeting our product to is clearly identifiable.
Yeah. And, you know, I think about it now. You look at these catalogs and you never see, you know, especially with perennials, they're not showing you the beginning. They're showing you like the plant when it's in this, its full, beautiful glory. And then, you know, you get it and you think, really? It's so much smaller than I thought it was going to be.
Exactly. There was one catalog. I got a kick out of this. One catalog writer, the owner, of course, was often the writer in the catalog, said, don't believe all those illustrations you see in those big fancy catalogs. They spend all that money and they show you this great plant, but you know when you grow it, it never becomes exactly like that, mm-hmm. which is a wonderful argument, as if right. to say, buy my plants because you don't have to pay as much because I have cheaper looking catalogs, which is what the case was.
Now, you include an example in your book of how far the seed and garden companies go with an illustration, which I love, from a catalog that's labeled An Unpleasant Home, before patronizing the nurserymen. And the house is run down, the grounds look unkept and shabby, and then below it is an image labeled A Pleasant Home, after patronizing the tree dealers. And this illustration is of a refined English estate, so pretty blatant advertising.
It certainly is. This is what your house is going to look like. And it was a very powerful illustration. And this was used by tree peddlers who were like sales representatives for nursery, mostly nursery companies that went around the country, particularly farms, and tried to sell shrubs and trees and vines from the nursery. And they would show them these illustrations, chromolithographs, and then they would say, this is what your property could become. But in that particular example, that again shows you that branding of the garden, which was clearly English, with the lawn, mm-hmm. the curved walkway, the flowering shrubs and the trees that line the property. All of that was clearly shown in that illustration, which is a wonderful illustration.
Yeah, it's great. You know, and you think about it too, you know, I guess it took a while for us to realize to have these beautiful English gardens with these sweeping lawns, you really need a gardening team. That's a tough garden to keep up.
It is. Well, William Robinson, who I mentioned earlier, was this prolific English writer and was a wonderful plantsman himself, came to America in the early 70s, and he traveled the country from New York to California. And he loved our native plants, but he said, when he got back home to England, he said, America has no gardens. America does not know how to garden. And so that was a theme that we have to learn from the English that was repeated here as well in the catalogs. Quite often, mm-hmm. the English can teach us how to garden. And all the catalog owners were wonderful educators, that they were very careful in giving their instructions on how to garden, how to create a lawn, for example, and how to maintain it, because they looked on themselves as educators mm-hmm. in their catalogs, which is what they did.
Right. And so these garden catalogs created the sales tools, but they also had how-to manuals that too aided in the sales both of products and, again, this image of the English garden. So products
exactly.
were
important. How, mm-hmm. I'm not only selling you these seeds and plants, I'm also selling you how you can create the garden for yourself. For example, the straight rows of vegetables. This is a story that I read in Wisconsin, where there were a lot of German immigrants in the 19th century. At one point, Mr. Vick, who was a wonderful seedsman from Rochester, New York, printed his catalog in German so that he could attract a lot of the German immigrants. And German immigrants who came to Wisconsin at that time were many times well-educated, who knew how to read, were quite capable of gardening. And they would garden in the way that they gardened in Germany, which was to put vegetables not in straight rows, but in groupings, sometimes in round groupings. And in the catalog, in Mr. Vick's catalogs, the vegetables were in straight rows because that was the way the English garden, in straight rows. And Mr. Vick illustrated that in his catalog. And so what happened after a while with German immigrants in Wisconsin, they wanted to have the straight rows of vegetables so they could be more American, so they could be like the American catalogs. And of course, it was really the English
right.
style.
We're talking with Thomas Mickey. His book is America's Romance with the English Garden. When you look at your yard and garden, do you see the impacts of the marketing of the English garden, or have you broken free from that model and embraced another look or feel? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. We mentioned the beautiful illustrations that are in your book, and many which come from historical seed and garden catalogs. Talk a little bit about where these images came from and how they aid in telling the story of our romance with the English garden.
Well, one of the things I noticed as I looked at the catalogs, from time to time I would find the same image in catalog A that I saw in catalog B. Well, immediately I thought, well, there was no copyright at that time, so people could take an image from one and use it in his or her other her catalog, which is what they did. But the ideas for the illustrations often came from the travels that the owners of these companies made. So they would travel to gardens both in this country and in England, of course. Mr. Vick went to England to look at gardens, and when he came back here, used that as an inspiration. Thomas Meehan, for example, who was a nurseryman in Philadelphia and had a nursery business, but also a wonderful magazine called Gardeners Monthly, often illustrated gardens that he saw abroad. So it was very common, as we do today. We visit gardens to get inspiration, and they visited gardens, and then they would have their artists draw up the garden that they saw.
Let's talk a little bit more about the specifics of the garden. Early on, the model had a more formal and symmetrical look, like those large, wealthy estates. But that changed as more middle-class and suburban Americans took up gardening?
Well, the formal model, which the English inherited probably at the end of the 1600s, Elizabethan age, is illustrated today in Hampton Court in London, which is a beautiful, formal, well-clipped hedges and so forth. And that was the formal period. When the 1700s arrived, there was a rebellion against this formality, and the English garden took on a more picturesque, more natural kind of look, which by the mid-1700s included this enormous lawn, which swept down from the main house to the end, almost the end of the property. And so that view, the picturesque view, is what eventually became the essence of the garden in the 19th century. You still had to have that lawn. And when the middle class began to garden, it was also including that particular lawn. For example, when you see the show, the TV show, Downton Abbey today, when you see that opening shot of the lawn which sweeps up to the wall of the castle, which is kind of yellowish.
Yeah.
That lawn is really a lawn of the 1700s in England. That was designed by Capability Brown, who was one of the most important landscape gardeners or landscape designers of the 1700s. He designed dozens of properties in England. He was the gardener to the king, and his primary kind of garden was to always have this lawn. So the lawn really entered English gardening primarily from the early 1700s and continued well into the 20th century.
Yeah. And when you think about that, when you're working on a TV show like Downton Abbey, and they have all of these consultants to get everything historically accurate, you have to get the lawn right, the gardens and the lawn right, don't you?
Exactly. And by the beginning of the 20th century, there was a movement to include more perennial beds. But in their particular shot that opens that show, you don't really see perennial beds. There are on that property behind the house other gardens, kitchen gardens, and perennial beds. But there are not in that lawn, which is really preeminently the mm-hmm. symbol of the 1700s, yeah. which is what they wanted to keep.
And so then, as we see more middle class gardeners and things, that's when we start to see some of those perennials move into maybe the front yard, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We began to see borders, especially towards the end of the 19th century, we began to see more perennial borders. Before that time, gardeners, especially in England, but also in the United States, used a lot of annuals on the lawn. And they did that in a very formal kind of design, which is really strange, called carpet bedding, which was almost like a carpet. Had filigree, had circles and diamonds in the shape of colored leaves in a bed on your lawn, which was high demand of maintenance, which demanded people clip them to a certain length, which is what people did. And some of the English said the Americans have outdone us in carpet bedding because we have these very extravagant forms on the lawn. And that was an era when annuals are really important. Annuals coming from South America, mm-hmm. from Asia and Africa to England first and then to America that people would use in the summer. And then eventually people began to use more perennials. But it mm-hmm. took a long time for perennials to get acceptance into the garden.
Right.
It really took Mr. Robinson's effort and Gertrude Jekyll, who are two important characters in the late 19th century gardening, who introduced the use of perennials in the borders. And now, of course, it's important for us as well.
Right. And again, this is where the catalogs and brochures come in handy, because whatever's in the catalogs and brochures, but I want that in my yard, right?
Exactly. And it was often that these catalogs had these carpet beds on the lawn. Mr. Henderson did this. Mr. Vick showed these very extravagant forms on the lawn of low-growing plants that formed this beautiful shape on the lawn, and that was called carpet bedding, and that's what people wanted. It's amazing how we still are like that today. Like, I'll see a plant that I found online that I say, oh, that would be a neat one to have in my garden, and then I get it. So mm-hmm. we're always looking outside of ourselves for inspiration,
right.
And of course, the catalog would arrive in January. It was time to arrive in January when it was cold, and
yep.
people would look at the catalog, and it was a heavenly inspiration for what my garden could look like in the summer.
Oh, don't we look forward to those catalogs in the middle of winter when our gardens aren't in bloom? And I do the same thing, but I've learned now that I make lists of, oh, I love this, and I love this, and I love this, but I don't get around to ordering them until, so I don't end up ordering all that stuff. But if I went with my impulse in January, I'd be in trouble.
It gives you ideas anyway.
Yeah, sure does.
What you could do, or what your garden, what your plantings could evolve into.
And,
but that when you think of it, somebody out in Kansas, for example, getting a catalog from a New York seedsman like Peter Henderson, this person would never go to New York, but getting a catalog out in the farmland of Kansas from New York City, which was a wonderful way to connect with the outside world and give me these ideas for how my garden could look.
Exactly. And so early on, the model also espoused the use of exotics versus native planties. So explain where that idea came from.
Well, the English were great plant collectors. Beginning in the 1600s, of course, a lot of American plants like the black-eyed Susan and false blue indigo and even our rhododendron were more popular in England than they were here in America. And many very astute seedsmen and nurserymen would say, it's too bad people don't respect our native plants. England loves them more than we do. It was only when the English would say, this is a great plant and we love it, that American seedsmen and nurserymen would then include it in the catalog. Native plants had a hard time being accepted in this country for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Especially because of the plant collectors and then finding these plants from China and then bringing them to England, and then they would come to America. And eventually, native plants had a stronger role in our gardens, eventually.
Yeah.
And today they have, of course, play a significant role. But even, I would say, within the last 10 or 15 years, it was a struggle for native plants to become accepted.
Absolutely, yeah, I think you're right. Because we always want something different than what everyone else has. Right?
Yes,
we want to have
yes.
that plant that people go, ooh, what is that?
Exactly. And believe it or not, Mindy, there are still people who travel the world looking for plants that would be great in American gardens. Mm. They are sometimes independent horticulturalists. Sometimes they work for growers who go to China, for example, go to Asia. And sometimes individual growers, people who just love to garden, will by crossbreeding or just by accident, have a plant appear in their garden, and somebody from one of these large growers will come and buy it from them, and then they will test it in their garden, and then eventually, if it succeeds, it becomes one of their entries in their catalog. So there's always this search for newer and better plants, and often from outside our own environment.
And then, of course, we get into that whole issue of invasive. Something comes from somewhere else which may not be invasive there, but ends up being invasive here, wherever here may be.
Exactly.
Some of the problems we have here in Massachusetts have stemmed from, people wanting some exotic plant that's just gone crazy.
Exactly. And so initially we thought it was really a great idea, but then we realize it is not. And so now we have this list of invasive plants that nurseries, for example, cannot sell anymore, which is a great idea because we do want to curtail
right.
that. But what astounds me is that we still are on the search for newer and better plants. That was also a great argument that the catalogs would often use, and I saw that over and over again. They called these new plants novelties.
Mm.
These are plants that are new for this season. And sometimes they would appear in the catalog the following year in the back pages, and sometimes they would disappear completely, as if to say, well, it was a novelty at one time, but now after a period of testing, we realize that it is not such a great plant, so we don't sell it anymore,
right.
Which is what happens.
And of course, it, in a way, it's the catalogs remind me of like fashion catalogs. It's like new this year. This is the in color in this particular flower, or, that's almost like the fashion world, isn't it?
Exactly. Gardening is fashion. There's fashion... And style is very much the way that these catalogs looked at gardening. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was talking with a grower, and he told me that the new word for gardening today is decorating.
Mm.
People
yeah.
no longer want to garden because they see garden as work, as weeding and digging and pruning, and people just want to look at something. And so people go to nurseries for what they could color their property with, as if they were painting a wall, they look for colors.
Mm-hmm.
Although that concept of decorating, as landscape as decorating, is not something new, because I did find it. When I heard that, I said, something clicked. I said, I saw that in the catalogs at
mm-hmm.
times. They didn't use the word decorating, but they used that kind of idea. Let me quote for you. This is a wonderful quote from Vic, who is one of my favorite seedsmen. He's from Rochester. He said, what we do in the gardening way is done for the appearance, the respectability of the thing, done for the same reason that we have a coat of paint put on the house or renew the wall hangings. That was in 1884, the Vic
wow.
Seed Company.
Yeah.
So saying that gardening is very much like fashion and style. And it's all right.
Yeah.
Look at it.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Thomas Mickey about his book, America's Romance with the English Garden. Our toll-free number, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. Before the break, we were talking about this so-called new term of decorating instead of gardening, but really not so new. And this is sort of a thing we see as a trend now where we have the advice givers, if you will, saying, treat these outside spaces as rooms, right? Where they're running.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that whole idea of decorating.
That concept, Exactly. So that you're decorating a room, as it were, when it's really your garden. A lot of people are reducing the amount of lawn they have by using that space as a perennial bed or a space for ornamental grasses so that they don't have to take care of the big lawn anymore. And that's another way that one might look at gardening as decorating.
Yeah. That's right. Well, I have done something similar. We've tried to reduce the amount of lawn and put more gardens in, thinking it was going to be easier. Though you still have to weed.
You still have to weed. I always say that 90% of gardening is weeding.
Right.
90%. And weeds, of course, the earlier you get them, the better. Sometimes it takes me a long time to address them. And so it's probably the end of June by the time I get to some of them.
I have a lot of weeds in my garden right now.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. The English garden model puts emphasis on bloom times for plants. But as we look to ways to enhance our gardens, we're really thinking about so many other ways to do that. When we talk about this decorating approach, using different foliage colors, forms, textures. It's not all really just about flowers.
Exactly. At the English collected plants in the 19th century that were wonderful foliage plants. For example, Coleus alternanthera, which are small plants. Coleus can get a little bit bigger, but they're wonderful plants that have leaf color, and that's their benefit in the garden. And they were great proponents of distinctive kinds of leaves. The yucca plant, for example, and banana plants even, and cannas. The Victorian period loved the extensive leaves of the canna plant, which today we see a lot of. A lot of people don't like them, but they're expressive of this bold statement of the leaf that you could have in the summer as a structural element in your garden.
And boy, talk about some of the different canna plants. So you have variegated and, you know, the lighter green, darker green. I mean, really, and the colors of the flowers themselves, you can really have some interesting looking plants. The thing is, you have to, in this area anyway, you have to dig the bulbs up in the fall.
Yes, you have to dig them up in the fall and then put them out again in the following spring. And of course, the wealthy English had conservatories or greenhouses until about the 1830s, and then the middle class, because glass became cheaper. Middle class began to have these small conservatories or greenhouses where people could start their seeds inside. And, of course, that's still important for some people to have the ability to do that.
Right. And, of course, then we had the house plants, which were also encouraged, especially when you think of the Victorian era. You could just see all the ferns and the spider plants in people's houses.
Exactly, exactly. There's a wonderful fernery, which is a conservatory just for ferns, at the Morris Arboretum, which is in Philadelphia. And it was built in about 1885, 1890. And it housed just ferns. And because the fern was a wonderful Victorian plant, because it had that big arching leaf that people loved to exhibit in the summertime. And so they would take containers and place them all around the garden as a wonderful summer expression. In the winter, then they would bring them inside and they would continue to grow, and they would be able to go into them during the cold of winter and enjoy that summer greenery by looking at the ferns that they housed.
Yeah, I used to do that myself. I no longer have the indoor-outdoor fern thing, but I have a habit. I like a lot of the exotics, which, of course, you can't really put in the ground. So my containers, I generally have some sort of exotic plant, and they keep growing, and I keep having to drag all this stuff into my basement in the winter. I keep saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. But sometimes you just can't help yourself.
Well, you're right. That's the thing about gardening. It's not always rational. You do things that kind of respond to another level.
It's not rational at all. I have a neighbor who's also a big gardener, and we laugh at ourselves because we need nothing. There's no space yet. We can't go buy a garden center without buying something, you know? We have a problem.
There are two kinds of gardeners. There's the one kind of gardener who has a plan for his or her garden and landscape. It's going to look this way, and therefore works very hard to create that on the ground. And then there's another kind of gardener called the collector. Mm-hmm. And this is a person who is given a plant, who sees a plant that he or she must have, who subscribes to some kind of once-a-month plant mailing where you're going to get one every month, who belongs to plant groups where you get a plant through an auction or a sale, and you must have that plant. So you're always squeezing in your collection.
Right.
So and those are two different.
So kinds. And that's so me. I'm always squeezing the collection, but I have to pull things out and give things away to make space for some of these new things. And, you know, the last few years, and I think there's a lot of people who suffer from this, too, is the dahlias. There's just so many different species of dahlias now, and I have to have them.
Yes, they're a beautiful, dahlia is my favorite flower of all flowers. I love the dahlia. And there are more and more, every year there are more coming out because there, of course, is a dahlia society. There's, mm-hmm. there's a society for every plant, and the dahlias come out with more blooms.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
The Horticulture Society in England, this is a neat connection. The Royal Horticulture Society started in the early 1800s, is reproduced in America with the Mass Hort Society, the New York Hort Society, and the Pennsylvania Hort Society, which were started about the same time. And these were wonderful expressions where the middle class, even though they were started by very wealthy gardeners for the most part, where the middle class could finally get some instruction about gardening mm-hmm. and go to garden shows. The horticulture societies were a wonderful way of democratizing gardening in this country eventually.
Mm. You know, and another thing, I think as you evolve, and we were talking about some of this sort of decorating and, you know, ways to use different foliage and colors and textures, I kind of used to poo-poo hostas, you know, I'd have a couple, but it's like, now I can't even tell you how many different species of hosta I have. And that whole issue of having to, you know, weed in these areas that I've created under some of the trees, hosta, and then you don't have as many weeds, but they really are an underrated plant.
They are, and they're a wonderful perennial, especially for shade. And William Robinson, in his book in the 1880s, when he talks about plants for the English garden, it was called the plantain lily or the funkia at that mm-hmm. time, said that this is a great plant for shady areas. Every garden should have this plant. So today, of course, we have hundreds of mm-hmm. varieties of hosta, and one looks similar to another one often, with the different name, really, but they look quite identical.
Yeah.
I was at the New England Hosta Society meeting last week, and they had the auction. And auctions are always a wonderful way where you can get plants. But the hosta, you can also get a plant that nobody else has. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful thing about auctions, that is a coveted plant. And one plant at the auction went for $650.
Wow. Yeah, but you know, you can divide those, though. And you think of all the ones you can have down the line. I don't know if I'd pay $650, though.
if you're a plant collector, just like people collect stamps, people will pay money because they want to have a hosta that nobody else has.
And
that's,
right.
And that's this urge to collect plants.
Yeah, exactly.
And plants, of course, feed that.
Yeah. And at the end of each chapter, you highlight a plant from your garden. And I'm wondering how you chose which plants to include.
Well, I did that at the beginning. I was just taking, I had Ralph Morang, who's a New Hampshire photographer, take these images of photos of plants in my garden. And I wasn't sure exactly how we were going to use them yet. But as I wrote the book, I realized that I had so many plants in my own garden that dated back to the 19th century or that were plants that we continue to grow today because they were important back there, that I decided to include at the end of each chapter a section called Featured Plant. And there I talk about this plant from my own garden. Mm-hmm. And so over the period, we took those photos over a period of 3 years because we did them in spring, summer, and fall, depending on the variety of plant and when it was blooming, if it indeed had a bloom. Mm-hmm. And that's how we chose them, because in that chapter, I do mention them on some level. And I therefore wanted to show there is a link. History is always a link, today's history linked to the past. I wanted to show that. Yeah. In the book.
I have 7 of the 10 you list, by the way, in my own yard.
Oh, wonderful.
And, you know, I was really happy to see you include the firecracker vine, which I only discovered last year. And what a fabulous vine that is.
Oh, that is a wonderful plant. It's underrated and unknown to a lot of people,
right.
But it is a wonderful plant. It's been around since the 1880s. It's a plant that originated in Mexico, and it was sold in England and then came here, of course. The English said, this is a wonderful annual vine. And then American seed catalogs said, if the English can talk about it and they grow it, we're going to grow it. So then it became popular here.
Yeah, I don't know
but
how.
It's very easy to grow. But you have to grow it with a small plant that you buy at a nursery in May.
Yes.
Because it takes a long time for the seed.
That's exactly what I did. I saw it at a nursery and I thought, this is really interesting. And it has these interesting flowers that are, you know, multicolored, like little orange, red, yellow, kind of that looks like a firecracker from a distance.
Exactly. What's neat about them, too, is they bloom now in August.
Yeah, they're great.
That's a neat feature. When nothing else is blooming, or very little is blooming, this vine is showing off these fabulous colors that fill the whole, whatever the vertical happens to be that you have it hanging on.
Yeah. Now, roses, I know you're not an expert on roses, but many people have entire gardens devoted entirely to roses. And you talk about the Crimson Rambler and your rose. And we have to talk about Michael Walsh, right a couple doors down. He was the head gardener for the Fay Estate here in Woods Hole.
And
where they had dedicated, 3 acres to growing thousands of roses. And, of course, that's where we get this Cape Cod Rambler.
Yes, Mr. Walsh was a wonderful rosarian. I think that the way that I came to his rose was that as I researched the Crimson Rambler rose was the rose of the century. It was introduced in England in 1892 and then came to America shortly thereafter. And it was in catalogs here in the United States way into the 1940s. The rose that Mr. Walsh came up with called Excelsa, he came up with several of them, but that one, Excelsa, is part of the family of the Crimson Rambler rose. Mm-hmm. And I did not know that when I discovered the Excelsa rose on my property. That predated our arrival on our property, that Excelsa rose. And it was identified by a rose expert for me as the Excelsa rose. And I was just delighted when I found it because it has all the features of the Crimson Rambler, but it has a more of an enduring flower and it doesn't have all the leaf problems that the Crimson Rambler had. And Mr. Walsh, of course, sold these all around the country, I think all around the world. And so Woods Hole, he's a rather, rather important rosarian.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, if folks want to take a look at that, between the Challenger House and the Woods Hole Historical Museum, 5 of Mr. Walsh's roses are on display there along the split rail fence. You can't really find them anymore. It's tough. They're tough to find. But we see them here, around here in Woods Hole, especially.
Yeah, they are. If you go online, you can find them. On my blog, AmericanGardening.net, I got a note one day or a comment from somebody in Australia, because I had written a post about the Excelsa rose. I got a comment from somebody in Australia who had just moved into a new property and found on that property the Excelsa rose.
Wow. That's exciting.
I thought that was a neat connection. That's the neat thing about plants. They travel the world.
That's right. They sure do. So, and naturescaping is an approach taking hold in different parts of the company, a technique that uses native plantings that in theory require less watering and maintenance, are a little bit hardier. Do you see that nurseries or greenhouses are trying to market this model of landscaping now?
Oh, they certainly are today. For example, many nurseries have a section simply dedicated to native plants so that people can identify them and buy them and grow them on their property. And so they encourage that. That's a really important thing to do because it's less maintenance. Once they establish themselves, it's less maintenance. And, of course, then they attract birds and all kinds of insects like butterflies. So it's really important to grow native plants if you can.
Well, see, and even if we all have those few exotics here or there or things that aren't native to our area, but if we can also incorporate the native plantings, that's really important for our native pollinators, which really are struggling in a lot of areas.
Exactly. So that you can have, I'm a firm believer in having some exotics, but make sure that you also include native plants in your garden.
Yeah, and be careful about invasives.
Yes, and watch the invasives.
Yeah. So we have about just a minute left. You took a trip to Europe earlier this summer and looking at some of the famous gardens. What'd you find?
I was at a conference and we did see some of the gardens, especially we went to Paris. I wanted to see Versailles. That was really important. I had never seen Versailles, but it took my breath away. It is such a large, formal garden, and it just goes on for acres and acres and acres. And it was really, really a mind-blowing for me experience, and I really, really loved it.
Yeah.
And that was the garden that was very popular until about 1700, that formal garden, even replicated in England as well.
All right, so you came away with some inspiration for what you're going to do in your garden, I'm sure, right?
Exactly.
Thomas Mickey is the author of America's Romance with the English Garden. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Can I mention my blog site?
We'll put a link to your blog on our website, capeandislands.org, so folks can come there and we'll put it there. I want to thank John Parker and Margaret Carsley for production assistance in Boston. I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point. with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.